Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamu alaikum, shalom, mahaba, ciao, bonjour, namaste. Jumbo! Bienvenidos! Hey, my name is Jed Lee. Welcome to Reading with Your Kids. We are beaming out to the world from the book-loving neighborhood of Reedville, the sweetest little neighborhood in all of Boston. We are so very happy and absolutely honored that you join us in our mission to help all families grow closer through reading. We do that by sharing fun, thoughtful, and thought-provoking conversations with fascinating guests who just happen to be writing books for kids of all ages. You can join us in this mission by telling all of your family and friends about the show, telling your kids' teachers, their librarian, the school crossing guard, that they can find us on the WREB AM/FM 24/7 radio network and on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, CastBox, Player FM, Audible, YouTube, wherever you find your favorite shows, you can find Reading with Your Kids. Two magnificent guests today. Christy Mandan is up first. She is celebrating Millie Floor Saves the Night. And later in the show, Claribel Ortega is here to celebrate the Witchling series. This episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Princess Naomi Helps a Unicorn, a dance-it-out creative movement story for young movers. Unicorns and horses and snakes, oh my! Interactive movement wrapped up in a charming story of sibling angst, anger management, compassion, and triumph. Fed up with her annoying sister, Naomi storms out of the castle, only to discover a unicorn in need of help. With a sense of purpose, she quickly forgets her anger. Princess Naomi is just one of the many wonderful books you can find at onceuponadance.com. Mother and daughter duo with a passion for dance and storytelling, they strive to share joyful movement, honor the beauty and discipline of ballet, and foster freedom of expression. Check it out today, onceuponadance.com. Get ready, adventure fans. Toby Baxter is back. And I Heart River Home, the fourth thrilling book in the Adventures of Toby Baxter series, written by Tim Wright, 13-year-old Toby dives into his most unexpected quest yet. He's battling trolls, navigating the sandpit of love, and getting stuck with an L-O-V-E compass. But when the girl of his dreams, Rainy, is kidnapped, Toby must summon more courage than ever before. All four books in the Adventures of Toby Baxter series have been honored as Reading With Your Kids certified great reads, each packed with fast-paced action, humor, and heart. So grab your copy of I Heart River Home today and join Toby on an unforgettable journey through River Home, where every page is an adventure. This episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Trumpet, the Miracle Wolf Pup Series. There's a brand new book in the series, and we're so excited to tell you all about it. Trumpet Becomes a Mom. In this exciting book, Trumpet and Lighthawk, now a bonded pair, start their own family with their very first litter of pups. Families can read together, schools can explore the importance of wolf packs and conservation, and Trumpet fans everywhere can celebrate this milestone in her incredible journey. Grab your copy today. Available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, select bookstores, and the Wolf Conservation Center, where Trumpet and her family live. Plus, 50% of all profits go right back to supporting the Wolf Conservation Center, with more donated to Lighthawk Conservation Flying. So grab your book today and have a group haul for Trumpet and her family. Join us right now from the beautiful state of Georgia. Our guest is here today to celebrate her brand new book. It's called Millie Floor Saves the Night. Please welcome to the show New York Times bestselling author Christy Mandan. Christy, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you on. Tell us all about this new picture book, please.
So Millie Floor Saves the Night is the sequel to Millie Floor's Poison Garden. And if in book one, in the Poison Garden, the residents of Garden Glen were afraid of anything that was different, calling it poison, then in book two, the residents of Garden Glen are most certainly afraid of the dark, calling it dangerous. And so Millifleur once again has to convince Garden Glen that what they think about the world may not be totally true, and that they should be brave and have courage to be curious and find out what the dark has to offer.
Why are these folks in Garden Glen, which sounds like a lovely place, why are they so anxious? What's going on here?
They are afraid of anything that's different. So I think that's a very timely kind of community right now is, humans just in general. We want to identify and categorize things and put things in boxes, right? And Millifleur shows up in Garden Glen where all the houses are exactly the same, not a blade of grass out of place. Everything is the same, and she doesn't fit into their box. And she continues through these books to not fit in their box. And thank goodness, because wouldn't that be so boring if we all were exactly the same? But learning about people who are different from us requires a bit of courage.
Yeah. You know, I as you're talking about Garden Glen and everything looking the same, I thankfully I've never lived where I had to deal with a homeowners association. And
well, I'll tell you something funny, Jed. Do you know, one of my friends is, she's very on Reddit. Mm-hmm. You know, the website Reddit. Now, I'm not a Reddit kind of person, but she's very into it. And she messaged me not long after the Poison Garden came out and said, "You'll never believe it. Millifleur's Poison Garden ended up on the Reddit." And I said, "Oh dear, which one?" And she said, "A homeowners association Reddit." And I said, "Well, I'm not surprised."
Yeah. My son is living in, I'm up here in Boston, in the Northeast, and, you know, just living in the city, you just kind of deal with what's what. But he's in a community with a homeowners association, and seemed like he ran afoul of them very quickly, shortly after the morning.
It's not hard to do, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of rules.
They did. They seemed to, like, measure his lawn, and I'm like,
Yes.
Get a life.
Live in Garden Glen, not a blade of grass out of place. Yeah.
So did you have a bad experience in some gated community somewhere that caused
No, you? No, I just was the kid when I was little who didn't fit in any of the prefabricated boxes. And it took me many, many years to realize that actually is just fine, that you can actually DIY your own box that you fit comfortably in. You do not have to squeeze yourself into any one box. My trouble as a kid was that I had a lot of friends and I could sit at this lunch table or that lunch table, but I did not fit only at one. And it seems very, I don't know if it's a very like American mentality or I don't know what it is, but there seems to be this notion of like pick a thing and stick with it or else we don't know what you're about. And I liked to flip from thing to thing to thing. And for so many years, I thought it made me irresponsible or flighty or, you know, just couldn't settle on any one thing. And now that I'm a grown up, I know actually, I was just living a very full life. I was experiencing all the things that I could experience. So I had goth friends. I was on the cheerleading squad. I was a horse girl. I had a collection of dead things at home. I had, you know, all kinds of, I could stand in each group and carry a conversation. Now that I'm a grown up, I know that's actually a great thing. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, I thought, I don't know where I fit. And so Millifleur ended up being the character I think I would have wanted to read about as a kid.
Yeah.
Someone who, she doesn't fit. And she's also not trying to, you know, the Rosebud Club is squarely against her garden. And then in book two, they're squarely against her unlit home. Turn your lights on. What do you mean? This is dangerous. And she's not trying to win over the people who are already convinced, that are already determined to misunderstand her, right? She is just going out and being her authentic self and letting those people that she attracts, you know, come to her. She's finding people who appreciate what she has to offer. So I think that's an important message, like, because you can try, you can turn on all your lights. It's not going to eliminate whatever your fears are. You can plant all roses. It's not going to make you fit in any better. You need to plant what you know, what's in your heart. And if you like the dark, then that's fine. The dark, in book two, we live on a property out here in rural Georgia where we have lightning bugs, fireflies, they're regionally, they're called different things. I found out in Jamaica, they're called peony wallies. So all around the world, they have different names. So
okay.
Whatever you call them, fireflies, lightning bugs. And so it started out kind of a, don't be afraid of the dark sort of book, because there's like wonderful things, you know, shooting stars and the lightning bugs and, rest. Thank goodness we need that. But then when I got to the end, I realized it also was, a challenge to readers to reevaluate the vocabulary that we use surrounding dark and light, and that using darkness as a shorthand for anything bad is not only is it untrue, but it's problematic, right? You know, then what do we do with dark emotions when we're sad or mad? You know, like, those aren't bad. Those are a full human experience. They're, what does that say about our peers in our classroom who are not just white, brown, black? What does that say about the people around us if we have a shorthand for dark equals bad, light equals good? But also on an ecological level, we need the darkness. Half of our lives are lived in it. So I got to the end of this book and realized, oh, there's actually a lot to be said here with this telling of don't be afraid of the dark actually had a lot baked into it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think you and I had a lot in common, except that I'm about 100 years older than you. I have a very vivid memory of going and hanging out with the kids in my neighborhood, but very oftentimes walking a mile to another neighborhood to hang out with some kids I might have met at school or in an activity, a Cub Scout, whatever it is. And I remember being in one of those other neighborhoods one time and thinking, this is kind of cool. That I get to go and I have friends here and I got friends there and I got friends who live right near me.
Yeah. It would just be so dull if we all were the same and lived the same. People are fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you ever watched Ted Lasso, the show Ted Lasso, but he had a whole scene where he basically says, don't be judgmental, be curious. Because there are just so many fascinating people. We are, in our home, a house full of autistics. And we are all, when I tell you, we are every flavor that you could possibly be of autistic in this house. None of us have the same, you know, sensory needs or, but it makes us more empathetic, I think, because, you know, one of our kids is a sensory seeker. He needs like to run. I mean, just the other night, I sent him out in the yard. It's like, run as fast as you can around the yard twice, you know, because he needed that. And the whole time he was squealing and yelling. And then I've got one upstairs who wouldn't speak a word all day, just quiet, clean, calm, doesn't like all of that sort of thing. So we're all so very different. And it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, I don't expect my quiet kid to be like my loud kid, but they have to coexist. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think Millie Fleur has a lot of that baked in as well. Like, she doesn't have to plant roses, But she does have to coexist with her community, and community is important. And so, you know, that's in the first book, she has the first annual Garden Glen plant and seed swap. You know, she's sharing a little bit of her weirdness with other people. Some of them grow it, some of them don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's a good message. I hope.
I absolutely love it. Our home, we've been blessed. We've hosted international kids in our home. So we have, and every one of them became family members. So we now have family members in Japan and China and Australia and India, Italy.
Cool.
It's just so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. The world is just, it's just a fascinating place. And I think if we were more curious about it instead of scared of it, we would all be a little happier, I think.
Where do you think the fear of different comes from?
No, I think it's I think it must go back to, I think my bachelor's degree is in sociology. You know, I have you can't see it, but a hunter-gatherer tattoo here. I think it probably goes back to hunter-gatherer societies, that if you were different, then you might be a danger to the group. You know, like if you didn't stay with the herd, so to speak, go with the flow. Maybe it comes from that. But on a modern day level, I think it, you know, I did an event not long ago at the Library of Congress. And in the keynote, they were talking about how the Librarian of Congress was talking about how this huge percentage, I'm not going to misspeak, because one thing about me is I'm going to forget. but this huge percentage of Americans, the literacy rate is not beyond a sixth grade level. And so I think that has something to do with it, because we're not reading stories and we're not experiencing worlds beyond our little echo chamber. It makes things seem scarier. Reading, I think, is just very important for building empathy, mm-hmm. especially in the early years. And so when we don't read these stories, fantasy, I think, is so important because it stretches our imagination of what we know in our little world. You know, like a lot of people brush dragons off as silly, or, you know, Lord of the Rings and all of it's fantastical, but it helps our brain, when we go out into the world, be able to imagine people that are different than what our experiences have been. So I think that probably on a modern day level is where that fear might be exacerbated, is in the declining literacy rates.
Yeah. Well, declining literacy rates is something that worries me a whole lot. I was just speaking yesterday to the new CEO of Reach Out and Read, a wonderful organization that encourages pediatricians to start talking about the benefits of reading with your kids at the earliest age. And there are so many statistics. Schools in big cities here in Boston, I thought, or Massachusetts, I think 30% of the kids are not reading on grade level. And there are some cities where there's 0% of the kids are on grade level in third and eighth grade. And that's a real serious problem, not only with reading your schoolwork, but as what you were talking about, just exposing yourself to different people and different cultures.
Yeah. And being a responsible citizen out in society, you have to be able to critically think, and reading is your first practice in that, in critical thinking. And if we're not reading as a whole beyond a sixth grade level, you know, if there's a large portion of the population that can't read beyond a sixth grade level, what does that say about, you know, the adults who are going out into society and making decisions for society? You know, it's important, and it snowballs. But also, I think beyond being able to critically understand, you know, scientific documents or medical research or, you know, political documents, your own rights as a citizen, that very first thing that literacy does is builds empathy. And that is the core value. So I hope that Millie Floor kind of shines a little bit of a light on that, that being able to empathize with each other is important.
Yeah. Did you know when you were in back in university getting that degree in sociology that you'd be one day talking to kids, putting those sociological thoughts?
No, I didn't. I always wanted to be an artist and an illustrator. But I, like I said, I've lived 1,000 lives since then. Excuse me. I have a cat who is trying to disrupt us. And so, no, I didn't. But all those lives that I've lived, I think, led me to here. Like, writing books now, even though I wanted to go to art school and I wanted to be an artist, I think if I'd have done it in my 20s, I wouldn't have the knowledge and the experience that I have now. And that sociology degree, I went to nursing school. I have a license, a cosmetology license. And that one, I've always thought, how does that one translate? But it does, because the stories that people will tell you when you are their hairstylist are fascinating. They're beyond, they're stranger than fiction. Mm-hmm. So, no, I had no idea, but I think that all of the things that I tried, all the hats that I wore, led me to writing these books.
Yeah. We do have a lot in common, Chrissy. My beautiful wife, until I started performing on stage, I had dozens of jobs and was very successful in all of them and loved all of them. She came out of school and went right into teaching and taught for 35 years and is happily retired right now. But she always makes fun of me. She's like, oh, dude, another job you had. But see,
it's the opposite for me. My husband, he came straight out of college. He works in his degree field and has for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So, like, he picked a thing and he stuck with it and he loves it. Uh-huh. I can relate. I love all the things.
Yeah. So, is there another thing you're thinking about thinking after writing or in addition to writing?
So the great thing about publishing is when you're creating worlds, you know, like, I don't have to switch jobs now. I can just switch books. And mm-hmm. So Millie Floor, actually, you're not going to be rid of her anytime soon. She has, but it's been like being shot out of a cannon with that girl. So we had Poison Garden in 2024, Saves the Night in 2025. Millie Floor's Pumpkin Problem comes out next July. 2026, and then there will be 4 more Millie Floor books until 2029. And then I also have a book with Simon & Schuster coming out in just a couple weeks on the 28th of this month called Bittersweet, about the Berlin candy bombers in post-war Berlin.
All right, you piqued my interest. Candy bomb. We spent a lot of time on Millie Floor Saves the Night.
Yeah.
What in the world is a candy bomber?
Yes. So after World War II ended, it ended in 1945. By 1948, Germany still lay in ruins, and the Allied forces had split up the country to take the responsibility of getting it back on its feet. So there was not a power vacuum left there. But the Soviets and the Allied forces could not agree on how that should be done. The Soviets wanted justice without kindness. They wanted to punish the people of Germany, and understandably. But the Allied forces, the UK, France, and the US, knew that that was a bad idea. That hurt people. And so it was better to get them a functioning government back on their feet and back into the world as a, you know, responsible political player. And so the Soviets tried to block access into Berlin and tried to starve the people. The Allied forces orchestrated an airlift. This was the Berlin airlift in 1948, where they flew in planes and landed every 45 seconds. That is not, when you hear that, I know it sounds like What do you mean? Every 45 seconds, a plane landed with dried potatoes, evaporated milk, beans, rice, all of the dried goods, coal, things that they needed to survive. Mm-hmm. But one pilot spoke with some kids and saw that the light had just gone out of their eyes. This was the next generation that would be coming up. And they had everything they needed to survive, but they had no joy. And so he took his candy ration from base, tied it up in a handkerchief, made a parachute out of another handkerchief, and dropped it out the plane when he landed with the dried material goods. And that turned into 23 tons of candy dropped to the children of West Berlin and changed the sentiment around the world of how we should respond to a former enemy in a post-war situation. And now Germany is, you know, rebuilt and mm-hmm. what it is today. But it could have been very different.
Right.
And so out of that book, the message there is that kids never are the enemy, no matter what complex geopolitical tactics are at play. Children are always collateral damage, and children live everywhere. And we have to remember that justice without empathy, it probably does not pan out the way that we hope it would. There has to be empathy.
You're writing about a lot of heavy topics, and I'm so happy that you are.
Thank you. That one was tough.
I bet. Do you have to write on a heavy topic like that for kids? Did it require you to get into a certain headspace?
Yes. You know, a picture book is typically for ages 4 to 8. You know, there can be a range outside of that, but in general, they're marketed to the 4 to 8 crowd. So it has to be developmentally appropriate. And a picture book is also often about 32 to 40 pages. There's no first act. You dive right into the action, and you got to do it in less than 1,000 words. And so anytime with this book, I do this with every book. I always come back to, why do kids care? Like, I might think this is fun to write. I might think this is fun to illustrate. This might be a good idea to me as a grown-up. Why do kids care about this? But with this book, I especially had to keep coming back to, what parts of this do kids care about? And also, I don't have a first act. I can't tell them everything that led up to how Germany got in this situation. Nor would it be... It would be tricky developmentally to explain all of that. We still have a hard time talking about World War II, even as adults. Mm-hmm. And so it kept coming back to, how do you show kindness when it's really hard? And do you need to solve every problem with your kindness? You don't. And also, you don't have to absolve someone of their atrocities to still show a kindness. It is hard, and it takes a lot of courage. It's way easier to be mean and show justice without the kindness. Those things are easier. The hard thing is to find the courage to figure out a way to be kind to someone that, you know, do they deserve it? Mm-hmm. Who decides? So I kept coming back to, these are big questions that kids in the 4 to 8 group, they're already asking on the playground. You know, mm-hmm. like, he was mean to me yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the same, but it is the same.
Right.
You know, like, how do you reconcile a bully and you not become the bully yourself? You know?
Right.
So, yeah.
I love it. We should tell everybody where they can go to find out more about Millie Floor Saves the Night, about the Poison Garden, about the candy bombers, and more about you.
Yeah, so you can find me at ChristyMandin.com, and I'm also on Instagram at ChristyMandin.
And she's not on Reddit.
Not on Reddit.
Only when her friends tell her to check it out.
No, nope, I get it secondhand.
We've had a great time speaking to the author, the creator of Millie Floor Saves the Night. Our guest has been Christy Mandin. Hey, Christy, thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Well, I'll let you know that this episode of Reading With Your Kids is also brought to you by We're Going on a Space Adventure, written by Marie Nichols. This is a Reading With Your Kids certified great read. Blasting off and speeding through space, Graham cheers to the moon and beyond. But Bracken quickly learns that Graham has a fear of flying and that he must manage control of the spaceship. On the moon, they narrowly escape a hideous monster as a crater explodes, and on Mars, they need to outrun Martian creatures or risk becoming their dinner. Hoping to find a friendlier planet, they decide to try Jupiter. Then clank, 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 something is attacking the spaceship. You and your kids are going to love this book. It's fun. It's exciting. It celebrates intergenerational friendships, and we love those. We're going on a space adventure by Marie Nichols. It is a Reading With Your Kids certified great read.
Attention, this important consumer alert is brought to you by CBC Funding. Hey, did you know it's possible to receive upfront money from your structured settlement, annuity, or pending lawsuit? It's true. If you are receiving a structured settlement spread out over time and you want a lump sum amount delivered immediately, then you need to call CBC Funding. With your cash today, you can pay off credit card debt, pay medical bills, fund your education, or improve your home. You don't need to wait. Structured settlements are commonly used to resolve personal injury lawsuits. Annuities, they're designed to spread payments out over 10 or 20 years. For many of you in need of money today, this simply does not work. If you have a structured settlement and you want cash now, call CBC's Settlement Funding. Here's the number.
800-442-0665. 800-442-0665. That's 800-442-0665.
Are you looking for a creative way to bond with your kids? Let me tell you all about Drawing With Your Kids, the ultimate destination for artistic adventures. Join us as we dive into the wonderful world of children's books with renowned illustrators guiding you step by step from beloved characters to whimsical scenes. Unleash your imagination and create cherished memories together. Whether you're a seasoned artist or just picking up a pencil, there's something for everyone at Drawing With Your Kids. Please visit our website, readingwithyourkids.com, and click on the Drawing With Your Kids link at the top of the page and let the creativity flow. Drawing With Your Kids, where every stroke brings stories to life. Join us right now to celebrate her brand new middle grade book. It's called The Witchlings. Please welcome to the show, Clarabelle Ortega. Clarabelle,
how are you? Hi, I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you on. The Witchlings. This is, we're 2 days away from Halloween. My daughter is up in Salem, Massachusetts, where she lives, trying to get out to her car amongst all of the visitors in that invader town. Tell us about this book.
Sure. So the fourth Witchlings book, which is called Scepter of Memories, just came out in September of this year. But if you're unfamiliar with the Witchlings series, it was basically inspired by the question, what would happen if the sorting hat put you nowhere? And it's about a trio of witches who are sorted as leftovers, spare witches that have less magic and less power and rights in their world. And they have to enact something called the impossible task, or they'll be turned into a trio of toads. That's book one. And then in book four, it's the first time that they are leaving their home of Ravenskill and venturing into this monster-infested expanse called the Enchanted Grim in search of a famed Scepter of Memories in order to save their home and stop the big bad guy from erasing everybody's memories for good.
And that's a lot of adventure there.
Yeah.
Where did the idea for this universe come from?
So I've always been like a huge fan of stories that follow like underdogs and like a ragtag group of friends. Like The Goonies is one of my favorite movies ever. I love that dynamic. And actually the way that the story of the Witchlings came about was really unusual. I was in between edits for my very first book called Ghost Squad. And I had to think about like what I wanted to write next. And when I sat down to brainstorm ideas, the first line of Witchling's Book One, which is, it was the night of the Black Moon ceremony, and the very last thing Seven Salazar wanted to be was a spare witch, just sort of popped into my brain. And I didn't know who Seven was. I didn't know what the Black Moon ceremony was. I didn't know what a spare witch was. I think deep down, I kind of knew the story that I wanted to tell. I wanted to tell the story of feeling like the other through a magical lens. But my brain gave me the gift of this first line of the book, and I sort of reverse engineered it from there. And it's also very much inspired by the Hudson Valley. They live in this place called the 12 Towns, and they are based off of the river towns in the Hudson Valley. And some of the places are kind of easy to identify, like Boggs Ferry is Dobbs Ferry. But my personal favorite is Yonkers, which is Blonkers. So it's very much inspired by my surroundings. I do live in New York, but also sort of the stories that I grew up loving.
You know, I've read a book not too long ago, and I've heard other people kind of share the same idea that they believe that ideas aren't something that are born in our imagination. There's something we kind of pluck out of the ether. So ideas come to us, and they might come to us and we don't act on them. So they go and find somebody else that's ready on it. The story of that sentence coming to you sounds exactly like that, that this was a story that wanted to get told and it found you and you responded.
Absolutely. I think that is very true. And I think that's why sometimes you see sort of like a lot of similar feeling books coming out around the same time. I think we all are inspired by the things that are happening to us collectively as people. And some of us absorb that in different ways. But I absolutely do think that stories just sort of come to us from some sort of source sometimes. And I feel very lucky that, you know, Witchlings presented itself to me in that way. It kind of felt special, that first line, when I thought of it, when I heard it, it felt special to me, and I kind of knew I needed to explore it. And I think I sat down and wrote the whole first chapter that day, and it's almost unchanged from the way that I wrote it the first time. I have it like in my notes app or something. I wrote it in my phone, of course. But yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, that's, I had a similar experience, although before you were born. I was tasked to create a disabilities awareness video for a project that I was running. And I was at a UB40 concert in Lowell, Massachusetts with some friends. And right in the middle of the concert, the whole video, the play of the video was right before my eyes, and I'm enjoying the music, but I'm also seeing this thing, and I'm like, I gotta remember this so I can write it down. And I get home, and of course there was a power outage when I got home, so I wrote the whole script by candlelight, and it was,
oh wow,
it got wonderful. And it was like you said, that there's very little that changed between that night and when it was finally produced.
Yeah, you got to always act on it, because if you tell yourself, I'll write it down later and I'll remember, you will not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this idea that you present in the series of you know, the spare witch, and no one wants to be a spare witch. I bet, you know, I'm hearing a lot of despair from young people because of AI and technology and you know, that AI is taking a lot of jobs and robotics is taking a lot of jobs. So I hear a lot of people in their 20s that feel like, what's going to happen to me? Where am I going to be able to work? And I'm imagining if there are 12 and 14-year-olds that are hearing the 20-year-olds that they look up to speaking in this way, that has to upset and worry a lot of these young teens.
Absolutely. I think I couldn't imagine kind of growing up these days where everything feels so bleak. And a lot of people say like young people aren't taking anything seriously and they're kind of nihilistic, but I'm like, well, can you blame them? Because we're not really presenting them with much of a future to look forward to. And I think that part of the biggest some of the biggest themes that I tackle in Witchlings is the power of like community and sticking together. And I think that at every level, when we're faced with this kind of thing, the most important thing to do is lean on one another, come to one another and try to organize, come up with ideas on how to push back against some of this, like, frankly, propaganda of mm-hmm. how easy it's going to be for AI to replace human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really important for us to not self-isolate and to reach out to one another. And to, I think the beauty of the internet is that it can connect us, but I think it has in many ways made us very separate and very isolated from one another. And I think that the answer to all of those issues is to turn to our communities and to really start local. I used to be a reporter, and one of the things that I always noticed whenever I was in any sort of, you know, meeting, community meeting, school board meeting, town meeting, is that it was all mostly older people. Mm-hmm. And they were making huge decisions for the towns that materially affected people on the ground day in or day out. But a lot of people were giving up their voice and not showing up for these community events because they weren't there, you know? And I think it's really important that we go back to that, because local government and local organizing and community organizing can take a lot of that despair and helplessness that we feel and turn it on their heads. So if there are kids or young people who are listening to this or watching this and they feel that despair, I would say start there. Start with helping your neighbors, feeding your neighbors, organizing with your neighbors, and seeing what you can do in your community first, and watch how that kind of grows and helps you to feel less helpless, because you're not helpless. Right. The system is just designed to make us feel like we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it interesting that the person who is sounding the alarm and encouraging everybody to lean on each other and be there for each other is writing this encouraging story by themselves?
Yeah. Often
that's a solitary job.
It is quite a solitary job. I think it's one of the most beautiful and hardest things about my job is that all I need is a pen and paper to do it. And my brain, which is great, but it can get lonely. I do a lot of working in the company of others. Like, I have a writing group where it's more so about just doing writing sprints together. And I love that. I think it's great because it's a way to like get out into the community and meet other writers and also feel a little less lonely. I'm a big coffee shop writer also. I don't mind the noise. I don't mind. Sometimes I leave my headphones off and just kind of like type away to like the people talking. The busier the coffee shop is, the better.
Cool. Very, very cool. One of the things that authors often tell me is that they were surprised by something one of their characters did. Witchlings, this is book 4 in the series, so your characters have gone through a lot of changes. I imagine we've met some new characters too along the way. What are some of the things that your characters have surprised you with?
I think that the Witchlings themselves, they always felt like very strong characters to me. They've grown so large in my mind as like figures, that it feels like I don't remember a time when I didn't know them. And it's so easy for me to write their characters because I feel like I just intrinsically know what they would do at any given time. I think the character that probably has surprised me the most in her development is Thorn. She's sort of like the quieter, sweeter witchlings of the three. And in book 2 specifically, she gets really angry and she sort of stands her ground. And I was like, whoa, I didn't know you had that in you, Thorn. But it makes a lot of sense because she is the quieter of the three, but it doesn't mean that she's not sure of herself. She just expresses herself differently. And I think for me growing up, I thought confidence equaled being loud. And Thorn has taught me that confidence can also be more quiet, that it can look different for everybody. And I think allowing her to be angry and to push back when she felt an injustice done towards her was really kind of comforting to me and a little bit surprising from her character when it happened.
Yeah. There's nothing quite as frightening as somebody that you know is angry and they're not saying a word.
Yeah. And someone who's that way and is usually sweet and kind, it's always like, uh-oh, I know I really messed up.
And at this time, boy.
Yeah.
So we talked about Quiet Thorn. Who are the other two witchlings?
So Seven is sort of the main character, Seven Salazar, and she starts off as sort of like a know-it-all, very smart, very accomplished, very determined, ambitious. She's sort of like the planner and the leader of the group. And then we have Valley Pepperhorn, who is actually Seven's bully at the very beginning of the series. And she is the fighter of the group, sort of the sassy one. She's the fan favorite, I would say, Valley. And she has had a lot of character development and growth.
Valley Pepperhorn.
Yes.
That name is even better than Bonkers. I love it. Where did you pull that name from?
So it's interesting because all of the names in the Witchling series are prophecies. So your name means something, and it could be something as small as, you know, being good at a certain task or sport, or it could have something to do with your fate or your death or the love of your life. And you don't know until like your name prophecy is revealed, and you don't know when that's going to happen. So Valley's first name, at least, is very, very significant to the story, as are all the other two witchlings.
Yeah. You know, I was asking where the story came from and the ideas for the different characters. I'm curious, as you were developing this universe, Did the universe, as it grew, did it surprise you at all in how it developed?
So from when I first started writing the book, I had a lot planned out from the very beginning. I would say it probably surprised me how dark it gets later on in the later books. It was always my intention to sort of have this underbelly of like corruption through the magic world, Ravenskill being this like beautiful idyllic town that has a lot of horrible secrets. But I think knowing that going into it and then actually writing it into the story and having this sort of like beautiful image of a place that you've created, showing the truth of it, it's almost a little bit heartbreaking to have to do it, but it's necessary for the story. So I think that was probably the hardest thing, to sort of like let them see that the world that they believed to be sort of one way was a different one, which is an unfortunate but really human and relatable feeling for many of us. And I really wanted to sort of like explore that feeling of realizing like, hey, things aren't what they seem, and there are wonderful people in my world, but there are also really horrible people.
Certainly. And that is a difficult reality for a lot of us to accept, because all the institutions that are created are human made, and so they're destined to be flawed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So cool. What are the plans for the future of the Witchlings? There are four books out in the series now. Are there more coming?
Yeah, I'm currently revising book 5, and that is the planned finale for this particular arc. I am hoping in the future, down the line, to do a graphic novel spinoff. I do have like a whole sort of like plot and storyline for that, and hopeful that that will happen. I have a lot of projects waiting in the wings after I finish book 5, so not sure exactly when I'd be able to do something like that, but that's the hope. But for this particular arc of the series and this particular part of the series, book 5 is the final one.
Well, you have an open invitation when book 5 is ready and the graphic novels to come back to celebrate them.
Thank you. I absolutely will, for sure.
Yeah. Before we go, I'm curious. We love, I mean, I love the fact that kids, any kid, especially nowadays, because we hear that literacy rates are really falling, and we hear that kids aren't reading these days, and that is, it's more than concerning. It's almost terrifying, because reading is so important. I love when kids are reading independently, but this is the Reading with Your Kids podcast, and we want to encourage families to continue reading with their kids when they're reading middle grade novels, maybe you don't curl up on the couch together and read it out loud, but maybe you listen to the audiobook together in the car, or maybe you co-read it by two copies of the book. Clarabelle would be very happy about that. And then talk about it on the way to soccer, on the, around the dinner table, yeah, on the way to ballet. What kind of conversations do you think families can have reading The Witchlings?
Oh my gosh, so many. I mean, the Witchling series is really inspired by the world around us, a lot of current events. So it opens up the conversation for things that are happening in our world through the lens, sort of like a safer lens of this magical world. It also deals with things like poverty and, you know, socioeconomic issues and abuse, in, especially in books one and two. So there are a lot of different topics that you can delve into just by reading Witchlings. I actually got a message today from a parent thanking me because Witchlings allowed her to kind of talk to her daughter about some of the things that are going on in our world through the lens of Witchlings so that she understood it in a way that is safe for kids, right? That feels more comforting for kids. So I would say if you're having a hard time explaining kind of anything that's going on right now, especially in the news, it's a good series to go through. And it's also like a fun adventure, and it balances kind of like that humor and the friendship. So it's not always heavy. It's not always talking about difficult topics, but the entry point is there.
Yeah. You were sharing with me before we hit record that you've had a number of books out before the Witchling series hit. And is there a project, a genre that you're hoping to attack and to be successful at that you haven't had a chance to explore yet?
Absolutely. So most all of my books have been middle grade books, and I am hopeful to break into the young adult fantasy space soon.
Okay, great, great. I want to challenge you to try a picture book.
Oh, those are hard.
I was going to say, it's, you know, it's like one thing telling a story with 50,000 or 100,000 words. It's another to tell the story with 500 words.
Yeah, those are difficult. I think they're a lot harder than people think they are. Perhaps someday I will work on that down the line. I have a pretty stacked schedule right now, but it's on the list for sure. Cool.
So one of the things I was going to ask you, are you working on multiple projects at the same time?
So thankfully right now I have the same editor for all of my projects. So it's more so of a finish one project, hop into the next right away. So the next project that I'll be working on is the revisions of my next graphic novel, which has been announced. It's called 30 Ways to Kill Your Avatar, about a girl who gets sucked into a video game that's like The Sims. And it's with the same illustrator who did Frizzy with me, Rose Busamra. Uh-huh. And we're very excited about that. So that one, I wrote the first draft, just waiting to finish this revision of Witchlings and then jumping into revisions for that book.
Excellent. Well, like I said, you have an open invitation. Why don't we tell everybody where they can go to find out more about The Witchlings and find out more about Clarabelle Ortega?
Sure. So you can find everything about me on my website, clarabelleortega.com. And I'm also on most social medias as Clarabelle_Ortega.
We've had a fantastic time talking about The Witchlings. It is the great series from our guest, New York Times bestselling author, Clarabelle Ortega. Clarabelle, thanks so much for being on Reading With Your Kids.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was super fun.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Reading With Your Kids and will join us for the next exciting episode of the show. Hey, if this episode made you smile or gave you something to think about, please think about sharing a link to the show with a friend or someone you love. Also, please consider leaving a 5-star review. It really, really helps. And of course, we don't want you to miss a moment of the show, so hit that subscribe button. We'd love for you to connect with us on social media, facebook.com/readingwithyourkids, @readingwithyourkids on Instagram, and @JedleyMagic on X. Our website is readingwithyourkids.com. And if you want to check out those Drawing With Your Kids videos that we mentioned earlier, go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/readingwithyourkids. Want to thank the folks who made today's show so wonderful. starting with our guest, Christy Mandan. Please be sure to check out Millie Floor Saves the Night. Also want to thank Claribel Ortega. Please be sure to check out her Witchlings series. I want to thank my team, Fatima Khan, Chris Doherty. I want to thank my beautiful wife for all the support she gives me. Most of all, we want to thank you. You are amazing. You're taking care of your kids. You're taking care of your partner. You're paying the bills. You're doing all that work. And still, you're finding time to make the world a better, kinder, more empathetic place. And you do that every time you read with your kids. I'll be looking for you in the next episode of Reading with Your Kids. We'll be right back.